Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am Sean M. Myers, one of your hosts, and with me as always is my co-host and bat cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
You know, Sean, I'm really frustrated. I have been trying to beat cousin Val at horseshoes, but he just makes every pressure throw. He's a real Iceman, and I'm just his Huckleberry. But enough about me. How you doing this month?
I'm better off than you, apparently. I'm talking to cousin Evan about dinosaurs, trains, and spies, but not in that order. We want to welcome back all-star podcaster and Fire and Water Network founding member, Chris Franklin. How are you, Chris? Did you bring any more of Cindy's goodies for us to eat?
I did, and thanks, guys. It's great to be back. But someone may want to tell Cousin Clark that is not pate he's eating. It's Ace's dog food. But I did bring some dishes, and since it's starting to get close to summer, things are warming up. I brought a cool entree and a cool dessert. First off, we have Alfred's Vichyssoise. It's supposed to be cold. Ooh. And for later, Dr. Shivel's Baked Alaska.
Ooh, wow. Man, you're bringing the fancy stuff. That's awesome.
I know. Paul, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is all about?
Batman Family was indeed a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 78, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Atom? Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out, and they're excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. So let's get into Detective Comics number 489, starring the Batman family, Sean.
This is Detective 489, and the cover date is April 1980, and it is now monthly. The release date was January 24th, 1980. The page count is 64 pages. The cover price is $1. The number of stories is 6.
And so the cover... Buckle in, listeners. Yeah,
our first 8-hour episode. Cover artist is Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano. Chris, can you describe the cover and tell us what you think of it?
Sure. Cover copy tells us this issue has 6 all-new thrillers starring the entire Batman family, although I think some people might argue that it doesn't feature the entire Batman family. The main cover blurb boasts a novel-length Robin Batgirl story. Batgirl sits unconscious in the foreground of a room full of tech equipment, at least 70s, 80s tech equipment, like real computers. In the background, Robin holding a burning punch card, maybe? Yeah. And he's saying, "With your memory destroyed, my secret's safe." The sidebar promises 2 Batman novelettes, plus Commissioner Gordon in his first solo story, and the Atom in a mini-epic. Alfred, unfortunately, doesn't get mentioned. He has a story too. As a kid, these type of covers did make me feel like I was getting more bang for my buck. I preferred the wraparound with vignettes of each story like we saw on First Detective Dollar Issue. We'll get into this, but holy gaslighting, Batman. Robin's intentions seem sinister. And you think that everything about this cover is probably a swerve. This isn't really going to happen in the story. But it's honestly not too far off, even if there's no cool brain apparatus involved. I do like that Batgirl's shoulder is overlapping the box frame, which I know Sean hates. I think it's an effective cover. That's my opinion. It got me to buy it as a kid. So there you go.
I like the cover a lot. We as comic buyers and readers are used to the swerve cover. Even I don't think it's as sinister as it seems on the cover. I love the staging of, or the placement of the characters is very, very, very well done. It is neat that the brain apparatus, the point in the front perfectly matches Batgirl's mask. So that's nice.
It's very well composed. Andrew knows what he's doing. His Batgirl looks great, except my big problem. Why is Ross Andrew drawing the Don Heck collar? Drives me crazy. Other than that, Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano, you can't go wrong. Interesting, Robin gets top billing, which we haven't seen a lot of that. It was usually Batgirl-Robin team up, and now it's a Robin-Batgirl, so I thought that was interesting. And I generally just don't like heroes or antagonistic towards each other on the cover, but we'll get into it when we get into the story. We will, of course, post the image of the cover as well as plenty of additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Sean, could you please remind our listeners where they can find that?
I'll be happy to. http://fireandwaterpodcast.com/. Now, let's jump into this first story. It's Creatures of the Night, starring Batman. It is 8 pages, written by J.M. DeMatteis, penciled by Irv Novik, inked by Vince Coletta, and later reprinted never. Batman in Creatures of the Night. While swinging through Gotham one night, the bat rope gets pulled out from the Batman's grip by a monstrously big bird. When he lands, he discovers the body of a dead hooker, seemingly drained of all of her blood. Just then, Moon the Mystic, a world-famous magician, enters the scene and tells Batman that he and his manservant Ivorn, has been chasing a vampire across 9 cities to stop him. Batman, of course, does not believe that vampires are real. In fact, he has discussed this with multiple alien friends, an Amazon, an Atlantean, and the Spirit of Vengeance, and they all agree with him that vampire, no way. The next evening, Batman catches the creature, but is startled by his appearance. The creature runs into a building, and soon, Moon the Mystic is thrown out of that very same building, followed closely by an escaping bird-like creature. Batman enters the building, but comes out with Ivorn. The next night, the only good thing in this story happens. We see Matches Malone as he checks out Moon's show. After a few cheap parlor tricks and a quick change demonstration, Batman has the case all figured out. Later that evening, the vampire is about to strike again, but Batman manages to punch the vampire in the mouth, which causes his fangs to fall out. Also falling out is a dove, falling out of the vampire's cape. Yup, Moon, who suffers a split personality, is chasing himself. Why? Because he was shocked to discover that his manservant Ivorn is actually a creature of the night. And the shock of this has put him on the waiting list to have a stay at Arkham Asylum. So overcome with guilt about this, Ivorn chooses this particular moment to commit sunshine suicide. Chris, what did you think of this magnificent epic?
I actually really like this one.
What?
I really do. And in fact, we covered this on House of Frankenstein already, but I'm a sucker for when Batman brushes up against the supernatural. I do have a real problem with the fact, though, that he's so reluctant to admit he's dealing with real vampires, because
I hate it when they do that. Yeah. It's like, come on, he lives in the DC universe.
He fought a vampire as recently as Detective Number 455, only 5 years before. You know, so this very book with the same logo on the cover, you know, that's part that I don't care for. I will say, though, like I pointed you guys, my dog-eared copy of this has been missing the first few spreads for a long time in the cover, but there's a very simian-like vampire close-up on page 7. Mm-hmm. Irv Novik does a very kind of frightening vampire. He's pretty inhuman-looking. He's kind of man-baddish in some ways. Mm-hmm. But that simian-like vampire on page 7 has haunted my dreams since I was like 4 years old or something. I think that's another reason I like this. And I kind of like the poetic ending with Ivorn. And so I'm a sucker for this. I'll let you guys talk about it some.
I'm horribly afraid of the vampire's wildly uneven mutton chop sideburns. That's what scares me the most. Paul, what do you think about this story?
I like the art throughout. I think the flip on page 1 is really cool. We know from the story standpoint that the vampire is going to be either Ivorn or Moon, and it's actually kind of both, which is a nice little twist. As you mentioned, Sean, big plus, we get Matches Malone again. I think that page is funny. We'll definitely show that in the gallery where you've got that simian-looking vampire, and then Batman punches him right in the face, and the teeth come flying out, so I do think that's funny. It took me until the second reading, guys, to realize that Ivorn killed himself by flying into the sun. What is the motivation? So my question is existential in this story. Okay, so Ivorn is a vampire. So presumably he's been doing vampire things before Moon discovered it, right? And yes. Then Moon discovers that Ivorn was a vampire 6 months ago or whenever. And then yes. Moon goes crazy. Okay, that's fine. And starts doing vampire things himself. And Ivorn knows it. He could have stopped him before. You know, it's like, what role did Batman really play in the resolution of the story? He discovered it, but it's not quite clear to me the sort of logic.
So I know this is an audio medium, so I'm assuming you air quoted logic of the story.
Yeah.
because that's my main issue with this story.
It's fun. It's interesting for sure. You got a split personality. You got vampires. You got all kinds of good stuff in here. You got great art. The problem is we're looking at this 45 years later and we're thinking about it too much.
I also think, to a great degree, one of the problems with this story, the author did not know this. This is the kickoff story of the book. So you think it's going to have more importance or be like a better story than what it is. I think that does it harm. Yeah. But also, Ivorn is a vampiric creature. Moon discovers this and can't accept that Ivorn is that. So he creates this other personality that he then chases because he can't deal with Ivorn being.
Right. So either Ivorn is bad and he would team up with them, or he's good, he would have stopped them before.
Well, yeah, we know this has happened at least, what, like 6 months before, because he's quote unquote chasing him across all these cities.
Right.
So then at this point, I guess the guilt catches up with Ivorn. And like, yeah, why did he choose this moment to commit suicide?
I think because he was confronted with the violence directly in Batman. And I mean, me and Cindy talked about this when we covered it. The fact that Ivorn calls him my sweet moon makes me wonder if there was either a relationship between the two or an reciprocated relationship. You know, this could
Christopher
J. Franklin. I don't know if it's J. Christopher J. Franklin. How dare you see homosexual subtext when it went completely over my head? I am offended, sir.
One, it's Dean, and two, Christopher Dean. But no, I'm sorry.
You should have caught that one, Sean. Yeah,
I know. Man, I swear I still love musicals. I promise.
Yeah, but we kind of wondered because he says, my sweet moon, and I think when he sees he's reduced to such madness, maybe that's another reason, like, he blames himself.
Oh, well, now I love this story.
Yeah, no, Chris, that helps. That helps. I think he realized that he should have done something sooner, maybe, or whatever, so yeah, okay.
This story has created a disappointment in me to our beloved Mike's Amazing World of Comics. So, seeing Matches Malone, I thought, hey, you know what? I ought to collect all of the appearance of Matches Malone because that'd be great. Mike's Amazing World has a character search, but I typed in Matches Malone and it is not on Mike's Amazing World of Comics. If any of our bat cousins just happen to have a complete timeline of Matches Malone, Isamu, do not do this research. If anyone already has a complete listing, I don't want anyone to do research, but if you already have a complete listing, please let me know. But
sounds like an article for back issue, Chris.
I should pitch that to Michael Urie. Yeah, let's do it. Or I can put it on 13th Dimension. There you go.
Yeah. Best aliases of superheroes and 13 best, where number one is Matches Malone.
Yeah, there you go. I will say one more thing. JMD Mateus will go on to create iVampire in a few years. And he also co-created his own Greenberg the Vampire. And he had Batman kind of sort of become a vampire on an episode of Batman, The Brave and the Bold, where he stalked the Justice League International. Yeah. And we covered that one too on House of Frankenstein. So, and in fact, I sent JMD Mateus some questions about that episode. And I'm like, were you interested in exploring vampires? Did you like Batman up against vampires? He's like, well, my first Batman story was Batman fighting a vampire. And I had a V8 moment. I'm like, yeah, of course it was.
That's awesome.
It was this one, right. So oh, this wow, is his cool. first Batman story.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. Well, he goes on to much greater things. There's no question about that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I went from sort of neutral to negative to much more positive on this from our discussions. Yeah,
thank you, Chris.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, now we're going to move on to the Bat timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at all the other titles that were published this month using, of course, Mike's Amazing World for the month of January 1980.
We're going to start off with Batman number 322. The title is Chaos Coming and Going. Bat Cousins, let me tell you, I love it when a hero goes against, quote-unquote, another hero's villain. Yeah. So in this issue, it's Batman, and he's going up against Captain Boomerang. Yeah. Like, anytime a villain is associated with a normal hero and that villain goes up against someone else, I love it. DC had that crossover, oh my God, probably 15 years ago, where that was the whole point. So Batman is going up against Captain Boomerang. It's a fantastic cover. Batman is basically horizontally across the cover, swinging in, and Captain Boomerang is using his boomerang to boomerang a truck. And I've never read the story, but I think it's a fantastic cover.
Brave and the Bold this month, it's number 161, stars Batman and Adam Strange. I always remember this one. This is a great story because the concept is really neat. Batman and Adam Strange switch places, and Batman has to solve a mystery on Ren while Adam Strange has to solve a case in Gotham City. I just like that. I thought that was a great concept. And then we move on to Justice League number 177. And it's got a pretty neat Rich Buckler cover, and it promises, quote, the most unexpected guest star of all, which is a bit much since that guest star is the Martian Manhunter. But it is great because he's now returned to the Justice League where he, of course, belongs.
That is a cool cover. Up next is Super Friends number 31. And that is the issue that guest stars Black Orchid, which is fantastic. Wonder Woman is running in and saying, great, Hera, why isn't that kryptonite harming Superman? And Superman says, I don't know, but somehow it is killing Black Orchid. And that's a neat story, especially to see such a rare character like Black Orchid done in that quote-unquote animated style. It's a cool story. And then also next is World's Finest number 262. And it has stories featuring Superman and Batman, Green Arrow, Black Canary, Aquaman, Hawkman, Captain Marvel. And it's a really cool cover because there's a girl and she's pointing at Batman and his cape is on fire. So it's, and of course you see the dinosaur in the background because it's at the Batcave.
Lots of fire in this month. Yeah. We'll get to that. But
this month is fire.
It's on fire.
So now, Chris, how about you? What's on your pull list?
I have got some pretty cool books. Actually, Batman 322, I did have that one. I think I had a Whitman version of that. I don't see that on here. Mike usually has the Whitman version, but I think I had two copies of that. One book I have that I just got in recent years is the Superheroes number 2. That's one of those General Foods giveaway comics. It's really cool. It's actually a Super Friends comic because it's got the five main Super Friends, even though they put superheroes on the cover, like we talked about on For All Mankind. They did that on merchandise sometimes. It didn't make a lot of sense.
So but is that a new story in those?
It's new stories in those.
And is it Super Friends themed, or do you have it too, Sean? I don't have this.
So there are four General Mills comics, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and then Superheroes. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Marvel and DC own the rights to Superheroes?
Yeah, they co-own the copyright to that term,
It's actually because of Mego, too, because Mego tried to copyright it, and they were like, no, you are not copywriting the name Superheroes, and they got together and copyrighted and even created that logo that they both used on different products,
Now, the only one of those four I have is Superheroes, which is Super Friends.
And they're superpowers comic size. They fit in perfectly with your superpowers mini comics that you got with your action figures. So,
And I don't know what the licensing deals would be, but I would love a volume of all of those free giveaway comic insert things like that. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, it's I think Dark Horse printed the Masters of the Universe comics all in one book. Why doesn't DC do that with the superpowers and then throw things like this into? It's a no-brainer.
But back to Chris's list.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. We're on my list. Sorry. I just picked weird vampire tales because, one, we're talking about vampires. I never own any of these, but they have these bonkers, salaciously gory covers.
Oh, yeah.
They're from MF Enterprises magazines. One's kind of less bonkers, but they're usually monster on monster horror. A Frankenstein monster is staking a vampire while a mummy's trying to stop him in the background or something. It's just insane. I've just seen scans from the interiors. I've never run across one in a while, but I'd like to actually buy one of these. Apparently they're not very good, but they're just balls to the wall crazy, and I'd kind of like to experience it. Green Lantern number 127 has an awesome cover. That is Brian Bolland's first U.S. work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had that one noted, too. It's great. I mean, what a cover, though, Chris.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, Brian Bolland's, next level. His realism's almost like Neil Adams, here, hold my beer, that type thing. When I first saw his work, I can't remember what I first saw it on. I remember thinking, it's like, is this actually comic book art? It looks so different. Yeah. So textured and so realistic.
This was great because you got all those alien Green Lanterns. I love it when they show all the dozens of alien Green Lanterns. I always love those group shots. I'm always looking, where's the broccoli head guy? And he's on this cover,
I hadn't realized that was Bolland.
Another fun space one is Crazy number 60 with Miss Piggy and her pigs in space, beaming aboard the motion picture version of the Enterprise. Kirk in his gray pajamas has his tongue sticking out. That's a fun one.
I just clicked on it. The title of the story is Star Tripe.
Nice. We got New Adventures of Superboy number 4, Astrolad. He should have gotten a Who's Who entry. Are you listening, Isamu? And apparently Clark Kent doesn't wear socks over his Superboy boot, which I think is interesting. Then on to Superman number 346. Like I said, this month's on fire. Yep. Lana is now either dead or severely burned. There's no way she could survive. Superman powers are out of whack. He has flame breath instead of freeze breath now, which I have that issue. That's a fun Ross Andrew cover.
After you eat too much garlic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which we were talking about copyrights. I'm surprised that he wasn't sued from Green Flame.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Did he propel himself by shooting the flame out of his mouth? Maybe his nose even? I don't know. And one real outlier that's really crazy. Superman 2 number 1 movie preview. I'm not sure if this is where it's supposed to be because one, this is not an adaptation, so don't get your hopes up, kids. Mario Puzo, his contract forbade any kind of comic adaptation unless they wanted to pay him like $1 million or something. This is a solid year before we get the movie in the U.S. The European release date was December 4th, 1980, and the U.S. release was June 19th, 1981. So I'm not sure this is where this is supposed to be as far as release date.
You don't know what it is? Page count zero.
Yeah, I think it's more like a behind the scenes. It's a little bit like the tabloid comic, the Treasury comic. Yeah, that type of thing. But it's cool. I'd love to have it. It may have come out this early, but it really seems way early.
So when I went to see Flash Gordon in the movie theater lobby, they were selling programs, maybe 16 pages. So I'm wondering if it's that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just have shots from the movie and actor bios and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
I think it is. I think that's what it is. I just can't imagine that it was released at this time. That's what I would have picked up off the newsstand.
All right. I, of course, had Adventure Comics because of Plastic Man. Got the General Mills books. Casper Digest Winners.
I knew you would want that. I knew you would want that.
The first issue. However,
did you go get that on eBay this morning, Sean?
I did not. Bad Cousins, if you are interested in this, I am not going to bid against you. I'm a little bit burned from the Richie Rich experience. It was my fault thinking it was a graphic novel.
But these are digest winners, Sean.
Yes. Eventually, I would like to have a Harvey digest of each. Like, I'm not going to get every Richie Rich Harvey digest, but I'd like to
bankrupt you.
I would like to have a Casper digest. I'm not going to get every single title, but I would like to have a representative, and it wouldn't have to be the first issue.
I've got a Casper Digest floating around here, I think, that I've had since I was a kid. It survived.
It's nice to have. Yeah, I have a bunch of Betty and Veronica and Laugh and stuff like that. Yeah. So the next one I don't care about, but I am going to get Doctor Who Weekly number 17, and I'll send it to Shag just to let him know that we support him in his Doctor Whoism. The next one is Flash number 284.
Yes.
And I really did have this. I actually think this may have been a subscription copy because I think I was getting the Flash subscription at this time. But it's great because it's Flash and you see him zooming back and no intention for that. But he's zooming back and forth through time and you see different periods of his career. Now, I do have a funny story about this. So basically on the cover is a full figure of the Flash. I grew up in Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. Every summer there was a street fair, and Spring Grove was such like a small sleepy town. This street fair was a huge, big deal. They had this guy that would paint onto your jeans or onto your denim jacket. And this was a huge thing. So I brought this issue for him to paint. And I had this figure of Flash on one of my pair of jeans.
Wow, that's really cool.
That's awesome.
Now, unfortunately, unlike Martin, I have not kept this through the years, so I cannot post a picture of this.
That's but really cool.
It did look really neat. He did a fantastic job, and it was right on my thigh on the jean, and it was fantastic.
Wow, that's really neat. I love this cover, too. The story's called Run, Flash, Run for Your Life, and I can't help thinking of Run, Barry, Run from the TV show. But I have to say, you get Tomahawk to bid on this. This is a great Ross Andrew, Dick Giordano cover, just like the one we have on this. And inside, you open it up, and there's 17 pages of Don Heck. You know, so apologies to my friend Dan, the Don Heck fan, but this is a bit of a Tomahawk.
I got to say, when this whole Death of Iris thing was going on, I couldn't find the Flash. I wasn't buying it, but I kept wondering, is the Flash in love with Batgirl? What's going on? And like, it's like dancing with her now.
Yeah.
You know, she was at a masquerade ball dressed as Batgirl, I know. But, you know, as a kid, I was confused. I thought Batgirl and Robin kind of had a thing going on.
Not after this month.
That's right.
Yeah. My next one is Fun and Games Magazine number 8, which is fantastic because it features hair-raising puzzles and it has Spider-Woman with huge, huge, huge mane of hair basically covering up the entire cover of Fun and Games Magazine.
That's a good
one. I did have New Adventures of Superboy number 4, of course. We will get into the whole twinning thing later on, but on the cover of Spider-Woman number 25 are two spider women, and it says "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo." One spider woman will have to go.
They're not pointing at each other. That's weird.
So this is such an inside out back and forth episode because we will be talking about Time Warp in a little bit, and of course, Time Warp number 4 went on sale with a bunch of stories. Now, I think this is one of the two issues I don't have, so I don't know what's going on with the cover, but the cover looks odd.
We're going to look for those for you at Baltimore this year, Sean. They're not going to be very expensive. We're going to look for those.
I have to say, the other thing, I am having a mind warp mystery, because the next one is Walt Disney, The Black Hole number 1. But didn't I just tell the story about how I lied about seeing the strings
you
on
did.
The robot?
You did.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what this one is since it's a number 1.
I don't know. This says Whitman, so this might be the Whitman. Cause the other one I thought was a Walt Disney's Classics
Gold
or something.
Key?
Gold Key, maybe. It's something like that. I bet it's the same inside.
Just
but
repackaged.
I don't
know. Okay. Yeah. Okay, because I almost was positive I came clean about my...
You would pass up on this because you bought it last month.
My lying little ways in elementary school. Paul will not lie about what he picked at the newsstand.
So I want to point out, on Amazing Spider-Man this month, we get a Spidey and the Dazzler with a cool Frank Miller cover. Early Frank Miller, which is neat. Fantastic Four number 217. How can I not get... By Herbie Betrayed by Bill Mantlow and John Byrne as penciler on his brief run before he just took over the writer and artist duties a couple years from now. Marvel Super Action number 18 reprints Avengers number 57, and that's where I would have read the first appearance of the Vision. And Marvel 2-in-1 number 62 was in its prime at this time. This issue guest stars Moondragon, who for some reason 14-year-old Paul really liked. I can't figure out why. And then my off-the-wall pick this month is Rook Magazine number 2. It's a Warren black and white. I've never read any of these, but it's got a really cool cover by Bob Larkin and a bunch of sci-fi stories. I may have to look around for a couple of these because that looked really neat to me.
With my bad printing quality, that person on the cover of Rook kind of looks like Han Solo.
The big sci-fi news, though, this month was Star Trek number 1 is out by Marvel. This is the Marvel series. I remember being really excited by a comic book with Star Trek in it, and the series let me down a bit. Bought all the Star Trek comics over the years. I definitely liked it a lot better when the license moved to DC, even though there were some of the same creators. But this is a fantastic cover by Steve Laiahola and reprints the first half or third of the movie adaption that was also in the Marvel Super Special. And then my final one is What If the Avengers Fought the Kree Skrull War Without Rick Jones?
Yeah.
I remember this because at the time, I had not yet read the Kree-Skrull War storyline. I remember being very confused by this comic book because this is one of those ones. We talked about the What If before that hinges on a certain point in time and things went different. And I didn't have the context because I didn't know what had happened in the real world, so to speak. That's why I picked that What If.
And of course, at the newsstand, the very last thing we cover is our man, Richie Rich, with 13 titles this month. And I'm wondering, maybe it was 13 because kids have Christmas money left over, maybe. So then they would come to the newsstand and buy Richie Rich when they got their candy.
Sure, in January.
This issue of Batman Family missed the perfect opportunity for Cadbury to cross over, too. So
let's move on to our second story. It is a Tales of Gotham City, but it stars Commissioner Gordon. And it is called When the Inmates Run the Madhouse. An 8-pager by Paul Kupperberg, who's new to our podcast. Irv Novick is the artist with Steve Mitchell providing the inks and also has never been reprinted. Gotham Penitentiary is in chaos. There is a riot going on and the prisoners are holding 50 guards hostage. What have they demanded? Jim Gordon. They say they will only negotiate with our favorite mustachioed police officer. Despite the pleas of the warden who says the inmates will kill him, Jim agrees to go in. He removes his service revolver and rolls up his sleeves and enters the prison. The leaders of the uprising, Goldie Rivers and Monk Nichols, are two cons that Gordon helped put away 5 years ago. A third member of their gang, Charlie Morgan, had gotten away and has been hiding ever since, plotting revenge on Commissioner Gordon, since during the escape, Jim had shot the fourth and final member of the gang, his kid brother, Max Morgan. Phew, got all that? Good, because during the riot, Charlie sneaks into the prison and meets up with his pals. They had staged the whole thing to get revenge on Jim, where he could not be protected by other cops or by Batman. Jim uses his ingenuity and a little bit of luck to extricate himself and seals himself in the control room. He phones Morgan and makes a deal that if Morgan calls off the riot and makes all the inmates return to their cells, he will come out of the control room and promises to give Morgan a shot at him in return. Gordon does indeed let him have his shot, but Morgan misses his chance. Gordon in turn knocks Morgan out and then shoots up the Gabriel's Horn computer, and all the prisoners are locked back in their cell. The end. Woo! That is a lot to fit into 8 pages. Chris, tell us what your thoughts are of this tale of Gotham City.
It's a nice pot boiler. I think this is a great showing for Gordon. This is action Gordon, as we usually see him in Bob Haney's Brave and the Bold. Me and Sisko have talked about that. He's more of an action guy in Brave and the Bold. And this is kind of that version. I think it influenced the Gordon we see today, you know, that's a little bit younger, doesn't even have gray hair anymore. It's more the Gary Oldman, Commissioner Gordon. You can see Gary Oldman doing this. It's a nice story. I thought it was really tight. You know, I know they got this Tales of Gotham City thing going, but I kind of wish they'd used that cool Commissioner Gordon logo and the badge. I thought it was a really nice, tight little story.
Yeah, that was my first point, too. We don't get the logo. Sorry, Martin, we don't get the Commissioner Gordon logo. How about you, Sean? What'd you think?
Chris is the master of segue. That definitely is my major problem with the story. I guess they thought up this, let's do a Tales of Gotham City, and now we're just going to shoehorn. Because it makes sense that Tales of Gotham City would be just regular people, literally members of the Batman family.
Right. Yeah.
Now, that I understand this is comics. There are things that you have to get over. Anytime a villain captures a hero and he monologues, instead of just shooting the person, which would make sense. Now, once you get over that, and one other thing, which I'll get into when we get into the synopsis, I do really like this story a lot.
I agree with all you guys. We get Irv Novik again, a little bit scratchier with Steve Mitchell inking Chris. Yeah. I don't know what your thoughts on that. It seems a little rougher, which I kind of like, actually.
Yeah.
It's an early Paul Kupperberg story, which is also cool. Definitely we see Paul Levitz bringing new writers, at least, into the lineup, which is mixed results. The one plot point that I liked was the fact that Jim had been on a tour of the prison the month before.
Yeah.
When you say tight, it's very believable that he would make the deal to have the prisoners go back in their cells, and then he shoots up the computer and he knows that if the computer goes down, all the doors lock immediately. So I thought that was very clever. The motivations of the guys and the revenge thing, that's a little weaker, but I really, really liked it.
I like the angle that they set up that he knows this system.
Yeah.
And he even said, boy, good thing I took that tour. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And they didn't overdo it. It wasn't too much of a, Chekhov's tour, but it was pretty well done. Let's walk through it real quickly. I mean, you see the warden outside at the beginning where there's this big one metal door. Gordon shows up and he takes his coat off on the next page and his gun and gives it to the guy at the door, and he goes in with his hands behind his neck. I mean, look, you could see this sort of being on a TV episode from the late 70s, right? Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
If Gotham was on in the late 70s.
This could be Jim Gordon in an episode of Adam 12.
You know? Yeah.
Page 3, and he goes in and sees the guys. He recognizes the two guys, Goldie Rivers and Monk Nichols. I should have guessed you two were behind it. I thought it was a little easy that the guy was able to sneak in. Some of that stuff's a little...
My favorite part of this story definitely is Jim's business with a chair. I absolutely love that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Such a great action sequence that is really believable.
Well, he sets it up. If you look at the top of page 6, he gets up from his chair after Morgan comes in. He gets behind the chair. He's like, okay, it's getting close. They're going to shoot me pretty soon now.
Yeah.
I can kind of believe they were waiting for this other guy to show up to shoot him. That's reasonable, right? And then he starts swinging the chair around, and a little bit of luck and a lot of good action there. I don't know. I really like that.
It seems like Gordon, too. I like that his hand hurts after he punches a guy out. He's getting older. So he's a little rusty, but he's still got it type thing. I like that. They're not suddenly de-aging him. That's a nice touch. I get the impression the guy they let in, I think this was all very prearranged. The prisoners are running the prison, so they were waiting at the door for him to show up, because he's been hiding. So it, makes sense. And he's like, it's basically you dirty rat. You killed my brother. it works out well.
My main beef with this, of course, is he says, okay, Gordon, I don't care about these goons. You got yourself a deal. They're talking on the phone. And then because they brokered this deal, all of the prisoners just go back into their cell. I've watched Orange is the New Black enough to know. And Oz. I've watched Oz enough to know.
Yeah, they don't just say, all right, we'll go back into our cells.
Okay, Josh, all right. It was fun while it lasted. Okay, recess is over.
Yeah. So then I do like at the end where he's got his glasses back up on his forehead. He's rubbing his eyes. You know, hey, get the warden back in here and take his prison back over. I pulled his bacon out of the fire. So come get him back in. I just really like that last panel. I just think that's really clever. And this was a fun little story. You know, I really liked it.
Yeah, it's nice. The Danny Glover, I'm getting too old for this. It's implied. It's implied.
Well, but before we leave this story, I want to do a really fun topic, that family history, this time for Irv Novick, a favorite of all of ours, I think, in the network. It's hard to believe that anybody listening to this podcast would not know who he is, and specifically for our era, how he had a long history illustrating Batman and then The Flash. But let's find out more about him. This segment is also amazingly topical and coincidental, I must confess, given that tomorrow's just published back issue number 150, with a spotlight on the 1970s Batman artists, with the lead article all about Irv Novick, written by Ed Catto, his quotes from two previous guests on Batman Family Reunion, Dan Greenfield and Jim Beard.
Ooh.
The whole issue is great, as usual, and of course, add a link to this issue in the show notes. There's also a few other sources, including his Wikipedia page, and even a interesting and lengthy article from Heritage Auctions from when his family finally sold a bunch of his artwork a number of years ago. So I thought that was neat. Novick was born in New York City in 1916, studied at the National Academy of Design, and apparently considered becoming a doctor. But beginning in 1939, Novick started drawing for MLJ Comics, the company that would later be known as Archie Comics, of course. He became the primary artist for their superhero comics, including co-creating The Shield, who, as we know, is the first patriotic superhero even before Captain America, and worked on something called Bob Phantom and Steel Sterling until MLJ cut back on his titles to focus more just on their Archie comics. He joined the Army in April of 1943 and served until the end of the war. From 1946 to 51, Novick worked in advertising and for the largely unsuccessful comic strips Cynthia and the Scarlet Avenger. His long association with DC began when he was hired by the editor Robert Kaniger, who had previously written some Novick illustrated comics for MLJ. Novick and Kaniger become friends and be colleagues for many years. Initially, Novick was primarily an artist on war comics, such as Our Army of War and occasionally romance comics, since that was what Kaniger was the editor of. Kaniger and Novick created The Silent Night in The Brave and the Bold number 1 in 1955, and Novick drew most of the early pre-Justice League covers of The Brave and the Bold, which are spectacular. Those covers are amazing. Just look them up. He also drew a lot of Wonder Woman covers during the 50s, which are also just bonkers. Kaniger loved working with Novick and told the Comics Journal in 1983 that his pal was, quote, a very special case, a rare talent, like a Brando or a De Niro who can't give a bad performance. Irv is incapable of drawing a bad line. So that was a nice quote. During this time, Novick was also freelancing for an advertising agency named Johnstone and Cushing. And in the early 60s, they made him an offer to work for them full time, which he accepted. His exit from comics was brief, though, as he was very unhappy in advertising and was lured back to DC by Kaniger with a freelance contract, a guarantee of steady work and certain perks, which was at the time unprecedented. Very unusual and may have been the first example of exclusive contracts like that. So that was neat. We've talked about the freelance artists trying to gang up or whatever, but Novick was valued so much by DC and Kaniger that they gave him that contract. In that back issue article, Paul Levitz is also quoted as saying Carmine Infantino also valued him enough that he was the only artist put on payroll with benefits in those years. He was probably the senior artist working for DC in my editorial days. Notwithstanding that, he had a thoroughly modern style, moving his camera well and composing pages imaginatively, which I think we'd all agree with that. Novick continued to work in the war and adventure titles through the 60s. In fact, you may know that a panel that Novick drew in All-American Man of War number 89 from 1962 of a U.S. Air Force plane shooting down an enemy plane with the onomatopoeia wham was later appropriated, that's a kind word, I'll say stolen, by Roy Lichtenstein for his painting of that same name a year later. That was a Novick panel. 1968 was a year of big changes at DC. Not only were there a lot of editorial and management changes, as we have talked about before, but DC finally came to terms with Bob Kane that the Bat stories now would no longer be produced exclusively by the Kane Studio. As such, Novick began drawing superhero titles such as Batman, Superman's Girlfriend, Lois Lane, and The Flash. His first Batman story was number 204 from 1968, and he illustrated some great stories during the transition from camp to gothic era in the early 1970s. Some highlights were Batman 217, One Bullet Too Many from 1969, where Dick Grayson goes off to college and Bruce and Alfred move into the Wayne Foundation building. Of course, he drew that first appearance of Dula Dent in Batman Family number 6 that we covered. He drew most of the issues of the Joker series from 1975 to 1976, as Rob McCarthy, I'm sure, would let us know. And one of my favorite Flash stories appeared in DC Special Series number 1, the 5-star superhero spectacular and called How to Prevent a Flash. No spoilers, but you should read it if you haven't, for both the story and the terrific Novik art. He drew Batman and the Flash stories pretty consistently until about 1980. Early 1980s, he remained under contract at DC, but his work started to appear less frequently, though, as his eyesight was failing. His last new work was published in Flash Special number 1 from 1990. It was a Jay Garrick story, actually. He didn't actually attend his first comic book convention until San Diego in 1995, long after he retired, and he would later tell comics historian John Coates that he was, quote, surprised at the amount of people and industry professionals who told me they were inspired by my work. Perhaps that's because some of the artists at DC owed their jobs to Novik. Many artists, among them Mike Grell, often shared the same tale. They would spend years showing their work to comics and newspaper editors. Then one day they'd meet Novik, usually in the DC offices, and he would send them to Julie Schwartz with the instructions, tell him Irv sent you. Quote, Irv Novik had one of the most solid careers in comics, much like the scenes he carved into Strathmore paper with a dark and definitive pencil line, Paul Levitz also wrote. There wasn't anything sketchy or tentative about Irv's artwork. He took you to a place and made it concrete and real, filled with genuine people. But he was very humble, says Novik's daughter and oldest child, Leslie Novik Frank. Very, very humble. Even when the kids came over, our friends knew what he did for a living, he would change the conversation and engage them in something else when they asked him about comic books. Novik's four children and his wife of 64 years, Sylvia, had some idea of what their father did for a living. We knew he was an artist and he drew comics, Leslie says, but the kids had to sneak to read them, save for the occasional romance comics that I saw some of the other girls thumbing through at summer camp. The house was filled with more respectable magazines like the New Yorker and National Geographic. There weren't copies of All-American, Man of War, Batman, or the Black Hood lying around the living room. The closest Leslie got to the world of comics was when she'd have to take the subway into Manhattan to deliver pages to Julie Schwartz or Carmine Infantino. And they would always ask, hey, where's your father? And I would tell them he's working on his next stories. But I knew all those guys and they were nice to me. Novik was one of the rare artists who wound up keeping a large portion of his work, which was returned to him, and he gifted over years to his kids, who as adults fell in love with the work to which they had paid little attention as his kids. He passed away on October 15th of 2004 at the ripe old age of 88. According to Make's Amazing World, Irv had 681 story credits, totaling nearly 8,600 pages of comic art plus over 230 covers. Thanks for listening. Wow, it was a fun one to do. He's been a long time favorite of a lot of ours, I would think.
Yeah, that was great, Paul. I was looking forward. I was hoping you were going to do Irv Novik before I saw where he had his story. Like, man, I hope he does Irv Novik.
Well, I've been trying to figure out when to do him because we had him early on, but we were doing the Golden Age, a lot of the Golden Age people at the beginning, and I'm like, that was a good time. He's got two stories in this issue.
Right. When I was a kid, the three primary Batman artists were Irv Novik, Don Newton, and Jim Aparo, you know, mm-hmm. And so that's kind of my Batman baseline.
Yeah.
And what a great baseline. Right, what a great place to start. I love how his style adapted with the times, like Paul Levitz said.
Yeah.
It was very fresh. I mean, you would have never guessed that this guy was a Golden Age artist still working in the 70s, you know.
Some of those other Golden Age artists, and we've talked about it, their best work was long behind them.
Right.
I'll have to say, though, those Brave and the Bold covers are really fun.
Oh, yeah.
15 years, but I finally collected all 24 of those.
Oh, wow. Nice.
They're really cool.
I've always been a big fan. I got to bring this up because I bring it up every time. I recognized Irv Novik's art style. It was like emblazoned in my brain. And when I got the Remco Energized Batman for Christmas one year, 1979, I believe, I remember thinking, I didn't know what Irv Novik's name was yet because I couldn't read, but I remember thinking, this looks like the way that one guy draws Batman.
Ah, very cool.
If you look at that figure, it looks like an Irv Novik Batman. So it's very cool. He's lanky. He's kind of lean built like his Batman. So it's really cool.
I think my main Irv Novik thing is Joker's chin.
Yeah. Yeah. Really long
so
and pointy.
Long and angular. Yeah.
I think his last Batman story was during the Invasion crossover, like a detective issue. And I remember thinking, oh, hey, he's back. And it still looked great, you know. And I'd been years since he'd drawn Batman before. So
yeah. Very cool.
Okay, moving on to the third story, The Mind Warp Mystery, starring Batgirl and Robin. 15 pages, written by Jack C. Harris, penciled by Don Heck, inked by Vince Coletta, later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020, and Batgirl, the Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 2 hardcover from 2019. Robin and Batgirl in The Mind Warp Mystery. Robin and Batgirl are back in action together again, this time trying to track down a New Carthage Gotham City drug connection. Their hopes to stop the drug ring goes out the window, literally, as the undercover cop falls to his death. Batgirl goes inside the building and finds an eyewitness, but the man only caught a glimpse and can't remember exactly what the man looked like. He knows it's somewhere in his memory, and because this is a Jack C. Harris story written, he makes the comment that he wished that there were something he could take to remember. That comment makes Robin remember that he knows about a Hudson University professor who is working on a memory drug. As Batgirl and Robin swing out of the building, she tells Robin that it's great that he keeps up with what his professors are working on at school. And Robin acts as if they don't know each other's secret identities. Days later, a helicopter that Babs did not have to rent lands at Hudson University. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that this helicopter was manufactured by Boeing, because when it lands, one of the landing wheels breaks. Our gang, no, not that our gang, of Robin, Batgirl, Commissioner Gordon, and Mr. Reynolds, the eyewitness, meet Professor Thiel and his late-to-the-meeting assistant, Mr. Boyd. The professor administers the memory drug to Mr. Reynolds, and it all goes swimmingly. Well, if that swim ends in a drowning, I mean, because Mr. Reynolds dies. So then we have a time jump of a month when we look in on Dick Grayson changing into Robin. And I'll say no more about that because I'm a gentleman, I am. Robin is responding to a bat signal, a regular one, not like a jack-o'-lantern looking mockery of a one, and meets up with Commissioner Gordon, who lets him know that a few days after the memory rememberer didn't quite work out well, that he ran into his daughter, Batgirl Barbara, but she didn't recognize him at all. He makes the comment that she might be having some kind of memory loss, which makes Robin think about how the professor and his assistant haven't been seen since Mr. Reynolds died. Robin tracks down Barbara and shows her that she is Batgirl. Babs is on her way to a meeting with the professor when it is revealed that because Commissioner Gordon was responsible for him using his drug before it was tested, the government canceled the funding for his research, and now he's going to get back at Gordon by taking away the memories of his daughter. It also comes out that Barbara has told the professor the secret identities of Robin and Batman. The professor's machine can store memories on cassette tapes and then be sold off or destroyed or used as a horrible ending to a wonderful partnership. Robin then figures out, or more accurate, really guesses, that the professor's assistant, Boyd, tampered with the memory rememberer and at that very moment is meeting with Commissioner Gordon. Fisticuffs ensue, a professor is shot, and we get to the last page of the story where Robin helps Barbara restore all of her memories, but holds one tape back. The tape that holds the secret identities of Robin and Batman. Robin lets Batgirl decide what she wants to do with the tape after telling her that he would prefer her not to know. She ends up burning the tape. Chris, what did you think of this story?
Okay, so I had to go back and look. Has Robin ever acted like he was upset that Barbara, knew his secret identity.
No, never.
No, he never has. This is out of left field, out of character. I don't know who.
That's the whole crux of the whole thing. That's what got me, even when I was a kid. I'm like, what? That's ridiculous. Yeah. Why would he act like that?
Back to the old patriarchal crap. It's okay for us to know your secret, but not for you to know ours, which is bull.
Always stuck in my craw for 40 years, I guess.
Paul, do you have any other initial...
Let's just start walking through, because if we go down the rabbit hole of that point, let's get over that. We all don't like that,
right?
How it ends. But why don't you walk us through?
I want you to get your copy, turn to the first page of the Batgirl and Robin story.
Yes.
And you see those horrible logos at the top. And then, Paul, I want you to read out loud that explosion balloon to the right of Batgirl's logo.
Oh my gosh, Sean. You know, let me read it backwards. Adventure, startling single, in together they now... There's a problem with it. Now they together in a single startling adventure. Now, unbelievable. Another typo. Paul Levitz, hire Brenda Pope already. Oh my goodness. Good catch, Sean. I had so focused on the horrible logos on that first page. I'm sure we'll hear from Martin on those. Those are such bad logos. They took the old-fashioned Robin logo, I think, and that used to be kind of circled and straightened it out, and it just, it looks bad.
Honestly, that typo, that's my main problem with this story.
The proofreader had their mind warped, obviously.
I guess that's true.
So we're at this, I guess like a drug bust kind of thing. They've been finding out about this New Carthage, Gotham City drug ring. They're on the scene, and this is absolutely not funny because an undercover cop is being thrown out of a window. But it does, it is not funny, but
Sean, this guy falls from the fourth story and Robin catches him. Wouldn't Robin be like splat if a guy fell from 40 feet?
But all of that's for naught because he was dead before he before he was thrown out
like
the window.
When
that's exactly so Batgirl rushes up the building, breaks through the window, finds an eyewitness. The eyewitness kind of knows that he saw him, but he can't really remember details. Commissioner Gordon is consoling Robin. That's when the guy, Mr. Reynolds, mentions, oh, you know, I saw him, but it's not locked in my memory. If only we had some way to go in. And of course, Jack C. Harris, they figure out, okay, Robin knows a professor.
That's it, says Robin. Yeah. I've had an idea.
Yeah. So I wasn't really going to get into Dom Heck.
Are you going to talk about page four?
Yeah, on page four.
Horrible.
When Robin and Batgirl are like, quote unquote, swinging out of the window, especially Robin. It just looks like he's walking out of the window.
It's the old Wayne Boring Superman trick where he's just walking through the air, you know?
Yeah,
that page, let's just say, not even Don Heck's best.
I don't even think Don Heck's ever seen a helicopter either, because I don't think that look like, doesn't really look like a helicopter.
It's a double whammy because the art is horrible and it says it's good that you keep up with your professors. My professors. Oh, come on, Dick. Are you still trying to pretend that you're not Bruce Wayne's ward after all we've been through together? Well, I'm not admitting anything, but I got sort of dumb.
And when did he ever not act like he was Bruce Wayne's
ward?
You know, I mean, once they figured it out, once it was out in the open, why did, you know?
This is totally, whether it was Paul Levitz or higher ups at DC saying, we want to put the genie back in the bottle, and they came up with this mind warping thing. I'm not going to blame Jack C. Harris for this. He might have come up with the solution to putting the genie in the bottle, but anyway, we're not going to talk anymore about it. Okay.
So then the helicopter lands at Hudson U. The landing wheel breaks apart. The helicopter falls over, but that doesn't really matter because everyone is safe. They get the eyewitness out of the helicopter. They go up to the professor's lab. They're about to start administering this memory rememberer to the eyewitness, Mr. Reynolds. Professor Thiel's assistant, Mr. Boyd, comes in. They administer. Mr. Reynolds drops dead. And then...
Yeah, it's like, oh no, he died. Oh well.
Yeah. A bunch of stuff happens. And I don't want to say like it doesn't matter, but I guess this stuff has to happen for the next part. Then we take a 1 month leap ahead of time. I don't think it's really explained well. We get what happens, but would they really be out of contact this long? Especially because they are actively working on this case. I had issues with that. A nice shot of Robin changing, which...
I thought you'd like that.
We have to move on because otherwise the only good thing I would fixate on.
I do want to bring up, though, that this is the first time as a kid I saw Robin, his uniform breakdown.
The mechanics of his outfit. Yeah,
that's cool. That is cool.
It's not too unlike what Burt Ward wore. Like a green t-shirt more, and the collar, he's like got the collar of his cape on his shirt, which is unusual.
Yeah.
But this is the way George Perez more or less drew it too.
Yep.
Based on the way Burt Ward's costume was. So this all tracks pretty well. So I like that.
So continuing your swinging theme, Sean, if you look at the bottom right of page 8, what is Robin swinging from?
It's a helicopter overhead.
He's not in Gotham City. He's at Hudson, right?
Yeah.
And on the countryside. Yeah.
There may be a Unispan above him. So he meets with Commissioner Gordon. Commissioner Gordon says, hey, I don't know if it's cool to tell you this, but guess what? My daughter's Batgirl. And I do think Robin should have said, yeah, I know. Or he should have said something. Commissioner Gordon says that he realizes that something's happened to his daughter because he saw her. He went up to approach her. She didn't know who he was. Robin said, okay, I'll take care of it. Robin goes to see Barbara. And this part I do kind of think is funny. He sees Barbara. He says, hey, Barbara, I know you don't know me, but I'm going to show you something. You're Batgirl. And he takes her purse and shows her purse. Now, originally, my thought was she just has the Batgirl costume in her purse and she never saw it. But I think because there's the sound effect that it says rip, I'm going to headcanon it and say it's almost like a Velcro side pouch, maybe.
Hidden panel on the
back
of the
house. I'm thinking maybe there's a secret panel.
All right, I'll buy that.
I'm trying to help this story, although I don't know why.
You helped 1% out of 100. So.
Well, just think about it. It's a good thing she didn't have her costume as was shown in her very first appearance, because Dick was like, here, let me take your skirt off, make it into your cape, your hat, pull your mask down. And she's like, get your hands off of me, you freaking creep.
So this is amazing. On the top of page 11, not the first panel, but the second panel, that's just the close-up of Barbara. This is Don Heckdron, but I think that picture of Barbara is very good.
It's
almost Dick Giordano-esque.
I think it's beautiful. Yeah. I agree with you. We've said before, I think Heck drew good-looking women. They might look flat sometimes. That could be a panel that Vince Coletta took longer on. I agree with you. It's a very attractive panel of Barb.
I feel like Vince Coletta's inks are better in this issue than normal on everybody. I kind of wonder, well, Paul Levitz is the editor here. He's probably, hey, man, put the eraser down. You know? Because Paul Levitz was already up in the company some, you know?
Yeah, he's moving up fast. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Barbara does admit that this costume seems somehow right. It's All Coming Back to Me Now by Celine Dion. Listen to the very long version because I love it. But Barbara admits that she's going to meet this professor. So then the professor admits everything about his whole plan, about how he's going to wipe away the memories.
So let me pause you here. Bottom of page 11, Robin's got the professor and is gripping him by his shirt. Don't push me around, Robin. You see, I know you're actually Dick Grayson. He's listened to the tape or heard Barbara talk. Barbara's standing right there. So this is the memory wipe. Wouldn't she?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she already re-knows it.
Now she re-knows it. But I do think at least the plot point here, the one good plot point, he loses the funding after the death and wants revenge. Okay, that's plausible. Even though all the other things leading up to and after are implausible, the losing of the funding and wanting revenge, I can buy that. I'm trying to find my good, right? I'm trying to find the positives, and that's one of them.
It is funny because the professor literally almost has like a joy buzzer in his hand that has a little needle kind of thing. He talks about this device that as she talks about the memories, they are gone, but saved on a tape to be bartered later. Then it comes out that Robin, I don't know how he figures out that, I don't think there are clues
off
there.
Panel. No, this is not fair play, Sean. Don't worry.
To Boyd being the bad guy. Yeah. But the professor says, oh my God, it's Boyd, not Commissioner Gordon's fault. So Boyd has Commissioner Gordon. And I'm about to say one other good thing about Don Heck. Robin comes in and smacks Boyd in the face. This is like when you see slow motion video of like, I think it's a horrible drawing, but I can like retcon it's supposed to be a slow motion punch.
Can I bring up something right here? Because we're talking about this moment. You guys brought this up last episode. You explained it away, but I don't think you can here. On page 14, as you're talking about, we start out in Thiel's lab with Boyd waiting on him to arrive, and he's got Jim at gunpoint. Batgirl and Robin interrupt, and suddenly we're outside.
Oh, that's right. I didn't even notice that. Yeah.
Gun goes off and kills Steve.
You're absolutely right.
That is fantastic.
You know, but no, he's not shooting at the window. There's trees in the background. He's outside now.
I mean, you know, the guy who found out Robin's identity has going to die at the end. So
right, yeah.
That's really good, Chris. You must have read that backwards.
I did, actually.
That's fantastic. We get to the last page, and before we get into this, well, first of all, it's great that Paul even noticed that he literally says, you're Dick Grayson. So that kind of is the out, too. I do almost have a no prize kind of thing that helps me with the end of this. Batgirl and Robin are sitting there. He's playing the cassette tapes for Barbara. As she listens to them, she's like, yes, I remember this. This seems right. Every time she hears something, it's right, it's correct. So all of her memories are restored, except the tape that has the memories of Batman and Robin, secret identities. And I will say, he does leave the choice up to her. So that definitely is a good thing.
Yeah.
But then she decides to burn the tape. So two things. First of all, she totally could have just listened to the tape and burned it so no one else could have gotten that tape. However, What I prefer is, okay, Bat Cousins, we're going to get into a little bit of a story. And I swear this will come back around. This is going to be a 20-minute long story about me and my life. But it's going to swing back around here. I'm a big Disney fan. I went to see Beauty and the Beast, whichever year that came out, 90, whatever. So I loved it, watched it. So there's a scene in Beauty and the Beast where they're sitting at the table and Belle is delicately sipping her soup with her pinky up. The camera cuts and it's the Beast and he's hog mauling the dish like all in a blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that scene made me laugh my super loud horse laugh for like the next 3 minutes. I just thought this was the funniest thing ever. That weekend or a couple days later, I was watching TV and there was a commercial, and in the commercial they had that scene of the Beast, and it made me realize, you know what, if I would have seen this commercial before I saw it in the movie theater, I probably would not have laughed my loud horse laugh. Almost ever since then, it dawned on me, I'm gonna see every Disney animated movie. I'm going to see every Jurassic Park movie. I'm going to see every Planet of the Apes movie. I'm going to see every Star Wars movie. They already have me. They don't need to lure me into these movies because I know I'm going to see it. I don't want to know what the story is. I want to see it. I want to see if I can figure it out on my own. When I do the USA Today crossword puzzles, there are three or four of the longest clues, and they usually have something to do with the title at the top. So I don't look at any of those crosswords. I just look at those longest letters in the puzzle by themselves because I want to see if I can figure it out. When my partner Amante is telling me he watched the movie with the other Catwoman. Oh, you mean Michelle Pfeiffer? No, the other Catwoman. And I say, oh, you mean Anne Hathaway? No, the other Catwoman. And I'm going, Julie Newmar, Eartha Kitt, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, the other Catwoman, you know, the Catwoman with the green mask. And I say, oh my God, do you mean Poison Ivy? And he's like, yeah, the other Catwoman. Like I always try to see if I can figure stuff out. So this is my no prize of where Barbara is saying, yeah, I'll just destroy this tape because I know I already knew this and I'm going to be able to figure this out in 3 days. So that's my no prize of where Barbara is taking on the challenge to see if she can figure out the identities of Batman and Robin again, because she already did it once, probably not even having to do it. So I'm thinking she's just taking this on as a challenge.
I can buy that. I mean, Barbara is not the one that comes off looking bad here, though, right? And so yeah. I can buy that for Barbara's motivation.
Yeah.
But I still don't like the way Dick comes off.
No, yeah. No. I do like the panel of Barbara. It's panel 3 on that last page. That's a really nice shot of her, too.
Yeah, there's, yeah.
It just the whole thing. Speedy knows Robin's secret identity. I mean, he's liable to pull a Karen Page and sell it for smack.
Yeah, that's actually very true. Yeah.
So the whole thing, I will say this is the new status quo or whatever, right? And there's not another Batgirl-Robin team-up in Detective. So this is the last one. Down the line, in Detective number 526, I guess editor Lynn Wein and writer Jerry Conway kind of thought this was bunk because Barbara shows up at Wayne Manor to retrieve Dick to become Robin. And she tells him, of course I know Bruce and you are Batman and Robin. I'm not stupid. I'm a detective. And then Dick says he thought they'd thrown her off their scent months ago. And she said, it seemed important, so important to you, I let you believe you had.
That actually ties in with Sean's theory. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
Wait, is 526, is that the mega issue, the red cover with the gold?
Okay, the big anniversary issue.
Chris pulling out issue numbers when he knows I'm horrible at that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the big all villains with the introduction of Jason Todd.
Yeah, it's an editorial thing. For some reason, Paul Levitz didn't like Barbara knowing. And Len Wein was like, yeah, that she's part of the Batman family. It's fine. Whew. Ready to move on?
Yes.
Thank goodness. We're going to move on to our fourth story. Starring...
And this one couldn't possibly be worse than the last one.
This one starring that noted Batman family member, the Atom. And no, Ray Palmer is not jumping up and down in Batman's brain, stimulating electrical impulses.
like Ratatouille.
This is the Atom starring in this story called Computer Crisis, a 5-page masterpiece written by our pal, our bat cousin, Bob Rozakis. Illustrated by Alex Saviaco, his first appearance on the podcast, inked by Vince Coletta, and yet again, never reprinted. Funny. The Atom in Computer Crisis. The Atom is currently fulfilling the most important task for any member of the Justice League of America. That's right. He is on monitor duty. Yeah, I know. What he's really doing, though, is killing time doing some mite-sized acrobatics while the computer works on some generic science problem. When the computer gives him an answer that is clearly wrong, he decides to shrink down and go inside the computer to see if he can find the problem. While there, he comes upon tiny Darlu aliens who the JLA fought about 30 issues ago, like 3 weeks in DCU time. Anyway, they chase him around some generic weird backgrounds until Ray enlarges to escape the computer. Turns out the aliens were hatched inside the computer and were looking for a way out. So he somehow lets them out and sends them on their way. The end. So, Chris, give us your thoughts on the Atom in the computer crisis.
Well, I really want to address the tiny-sized elephant in the room, which is why the crap is the Atom in this book? I did a little research. I don't have any concrete answers, but I think I might have something figured out.
All I could come up with was a couple clues, so I'd like to hear your rationale.
Maybe we can suss it out together. Paul Levitz in the letters column, which we'll get to, mentions that there might be a few rough edges because the book's going to monthly. Okay. Right. So Razakis and Saviak had been producing rotating Atom backups in Action Comics, edited by Julius Schwartz.
Right.
And then just a few months prior, he'd appeared in World's Finest number 260, December, January 1979, which Mike, Amazing World, credits to Jack C. Harris. But Ross Andrew here is listed
right.
as
guest That was editor. The thing that confused me, yeah.
Ross Andrew was also the editor of Adventure Comics during its Dollar Comics phase. So this was shortly before this. And then when Starman and Plastic Man became the stars, Len Wein took over. Andrew was also editing Justice League of America. So it's possible that this may have been just a fill-in in case the Justice League story runs short, or at one point the Atom strip was going to move to Adventure Comics before they changed it from a dollar comic to a regular size comic with Plastic Man and Starman.
Yeah, I like that. It was commissioned by Ross Andrew. No, that's really good because I was trying to figure out the Ross Andrew connection, and that's got to be at the Adventure Comics. That's really good, Chris. Well done.
Well, I thought I'd do some detective work for Detective Comics. So, yeah. I will point out, though, that the Atom did appear in Detective number 463 during the whole calculator storyline.
He did.
Okay.
He did have a detective strip, and he, of course, appeared in a couple other issues during that, and then, of course, the big finale where the Justice League played the calculator, drawn by Marshall Rogers.
I don't know that we need to go. There's not very many beats in this story. I remember that story when they reference it on the bottom of page 2 where you've got the alien who sort of looks like a merged version of Hawkman and the Flash. I remember that because that was a very, very early issue of Justice League that I had ever gotten. I always thought that was a bigger deal than it was, this sort of squished together Hawkman Flash character. So that, to me, brought back that image. But other than that, the best part for me is on page 5 when the Atom comes out of the computer to full size. He shows up in his Ray Palmer suit. I like that. Yeah. I got nothing, guys.
There's nothing bad or wrong necessarily with this story. Not this story, but if you're going to have 5 pages and it's like, you might as well, I understand what Chris was saying, but like, it should have been whatever, like a Slam Bradley story or something like that. Now, obviously, Slam Bradley isn't going to have a computer crisis or whatever. I like the art, kind of good, quote unquote, special effects with the shrinking and stuff like that.
I like Alex Saviak's art. I think he's a solid, kind of underrated. He's got a very clean, very house style about him. And he, of course, he had a pretty good career at DC and then a lengthy run on Spider-Man, particularly Web of Spider-Man. Yeah. And he drew some of the Superpowers mini comics and even some of the packaging art. I think he did Green Arrow.
Did he? I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, so he got around a lot and I always liked this stuff. I think this is just an inventory story and they needed, where it's going monthly, they had to have something to fill some pages and here you go.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay, now we are moving on to bat branding. And this is where we take a look at the non-story pages in this issue. And we are actually going to start on the inside front cover, which is Vroom. Superhero cars mean great fun that fits in your pocket. Now, this kind of sounds like the ad from last time where Superman was showing Lois Lane off the parking lot of the Daily Planet. But this time there are a lot more vehicles. So we'll skip the ones that we talked about last time, which is like the helicopter and the supermobile. Because now there's a Penguin Mobile, there's a Joker Mobile, Bat Helicopter, a Bat Cycle, the Batmobile, Wonder Woman has a car, and Shazam has a car, Captain Marvel has a car, and I had that Shazam car.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was probably one of the only matchboxes that I ever had. And the ad itself is cool because the vehicles are all kind of in a U-shaped formation. And in the middle of the U, it's almost like the Super Friends, and they're all running towards their vehicles. So I really like the ad a lot.
Yeah, that's cool.
This ad is one of my favorites. It, you know, lived in my brain for years, another thing. And it ran in several comics back then. And I had a lot of these, still had, and I picked up some over the years. I don't have the Shazam or Wonder Woman. I had the Joker mobile, and I got it back a few years ago. And I've got some of the different, of course, they made bigger ones and smaller ones of some of these. These are the pocket or Corgi Jr. ones. This made it look like you need to own this entire fleet of these.
That looks like a fleet. That's a good word.
I don't know if Captain Marvel, being from Earth-S, knew that Clark Kent was Superman, but now he does because he ran past that truck. It's wonderful. And hey, there's the Batcopter that we talked about the last time I was on the show that Marshall Rogers drew into the Batman.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
And then the next ad is a Twinkies ad. Yay! And it is Wonder Woman in The Borrower, which I don't know why he's a borrower and not a stealer. But Martin, you will love the part where Wonder Woman is trying to slow him down by putting out some Twinkies for him to take. And he says, "Are these the same Twinkies I borrowed as a boy?" And Martin probably thinks they're the exact same package of Twinkies that have been around for 30 years.
Well, they'll survive a nuclear holocaust, right?
So exactly. We know that, right?
Is this guy related to Harry or Lloyd from Dumb and Dumber, leaving all those IOUs? And I think he's writing one to Julius Schwartz in the top right panel. That kind of looks like him.
Oh, yeah.
It does. That's so funny.
Where are Diana's glasses, though? That's what I want to know. She doesn't have her glasses on. How's she Diana Prince without her glasses on? I'm confused. But Kurt, what were you doing? This is obviously Kurt Swan. So what were you doing that day?
He forgot, I guess.
He was drawing this with his foot because he was drawing 14 other things with his hands. It looks good, though.
Moving on, after page 10 of the Batgirl Robin story, the centerfold, we get a one-page ad, a subscription ad for Batman and Detective with Jim Aparo art, and it's really neat. Will Selina be convicted of the new cat crimes? It's got all these things. Why does Man-Bat want revenge on Batman? Can Black Lightning help? Be sure you get Batman or The Brave and the Bold, which by subscribing at a terrific discount rates, which is really neat. And at the same time, I'll point out, there's also a Detective Comics subscription ad right before the Adam story. This one looks more like Dick Giordano, and it's got Robin running in. He's, "Batman, I've cracked the case." "What, you've got a bargain? You can now get $12 comics for only $10 and Detective Comics mailed to you flat." And it shows we've got Batgirl, Robin, Black Lightning is joining with Batman all in one great magazine. So that's kind of neat that we've got those two ads in this book. You can tell that they're really trying to push the Caped Crusader. So did you have subscriptions, Chris?
I did not. I did later subscribe to some books. But if you don't mind, I can give you a rundown when you find out when all these mysteries are solved on the Bill book.
Oh, look at you. Let's do it.
Catwoman's storyline comes to a head in Batman number 324. Spoiler, it's Catman committing the cat crimes. The Commissioner Gordon murder case story is in Batman 325. Sis Gordon and I will be covering the Scalp Hunter issue later this year. That's Brave the Bold number 171. February 1981, so it didn't ship until late November of 1980. So that's
that's a long way out. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
And he needs a lot of time to do his work, so they might have knew about it ahead of time. So maybe that's why. Len Wein's favorite Professor Milo uses insanity as a weapon in Batman number 327. Man-Bat thinks Batman is responsible for his daughter's illness in Brave and the Bold number 165. And Batman teams up with Black Lightning in B&B number 163. So there you go.
Nicely done. I didn't even think to do that. See, there's a reason we have this guy on.
I remember these subscription at 12 comics for the price of 10, no matter what the price was. But I don't know that these ran in every single DC comic, but I think every DC comic I was because I know there's one with Super Friends. I think there's one with Legion. I said, I wish they would collect the promo comics. I know Mike's Amazing World of Comics has all of the Daily Planet strips. I would like to see if someone has a collection of all of these subscription ads, because I think they're really, really well done. Oh, there's Superman visiting the woman at the subscription booth or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good one
too. Yeah. So all of those subscription ads, I would like to see all of them back to back to back to back.
I like how they emphasize that it's mailed flat, because I know they used to, before this, they folded your comic books.
Yep.
Well,
so they had those subscription creases.
My first subscription was The Flash, and you would get it in a brown envelope, and it was always folded. So that first year of Flash, when that was done, I switched over to Best of DC Digest. Now, the nice thing is, because that was a digest, it wasn't folded. That I didn't have to worry about.
Somebody's trying to fold them, like, and then putting it in an envelope and smelling it.
They'd probably fold it the other way to crack the spine.
There you go.
Bat Cousins, you're going to get a behind the scenes because in our script, it says the next page, fly your own airplane. Sean, if you or Chris want to cover it, I don't really want to cover it, but if Chris has something to talk about these airplanes, I guess are they styrofoam? That's my guess.
I guess they got to be styrofoam. Yeah. Because those things last like 2 seconds. Throw them and they sail for pretty good for like 2 seconds. And then when they hit, they just shatter into styrofoam. They suck. Some company made a bat plane during this era. I've seen it before. It's got really cool graphics on the package, but I've never owned it. I'm sure not very many have survived unless they're still in the package because it's styrofoam. You know?
I can't get it out of a box when it comes shipped to my house without it breaking.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to flip the order. So there is a half page ad for Time Warp, which is fantastic. You see a little bit more of the cover, what's going on. I guess there's some kind of demonic creatures. And there's a guy who I first thought he had a sword, but I think it's a little Gabriel's horn. And he kind of looks like Extrano, maybe.
A little bit.
Yeah, he does.
So Bat Cousins, don't bid against me on eBay for that. Then we're going to end it all. We're not going to end it all. I'm not going to commit sunshine suicide.
Was that a song by Donovan, Sunshine Suicide? Superman and Green Lantern.
We're going to finish this section with a look at the Batcave, which was the letters column. So as always, we're going to invite Dean Shop from Vancouver, British Columbia, Jeffrey Lowndes, Lowndes, from Scranton, PA, and Brian Nelson, who wrote a novel from Rockville, Maryland. But at the beginning, Paul Levitz has an editorial box, and I'm going to read that. It says, "Dear readers, before we begin this issue's letters section, we'd like to thank you for your continued and enthusiastic support, which has brought this magazine back to monthly frequency. Detective Comics is DC's first attempt to publish a monthly $1 comic, and we feel that it's appropriate bit of pioneering since Detective was the first comic to feature all new material in every issue way back in the 1930s. While the changeover to monthly may leave us with a few rough edges showing this time or next, we feel we have the talented writers and artists available to make the change successfully, and the final product will be one of the best comics on the newsstand. Barring unforeseen events, like a new burst of editorial inspiration, our lineup each issue will be a full-length Batman novel, short stories of Robin and Batgirl, a new series of Black Lightning adventures, and a rotating spot that will feature the Tales of the Gotham City series introduced this issue." Well, it says introduced this issue, but it was
last
in the
previous. Yeah.
"The Human Target by Len Wein and Dick Giordano, which will be back as soon as Len and Dick can finish a story, or special stories featuring Alfred, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and other members of the Batman family. We hope that you enjoy it as much as we do. Thanks once again, Paul Levitz." Now, I will say they did do a $1 Detective Comics, but I think it only lasts maybe for like 7 more issues, and it is done.
I think it's interesting. I looked up some of the creators. Mike Barr writes one Batgirl story, and he's listed as being the new writer.
Yep.
Don Heck isn't the artist, and he's listed as being the artist.
Denny O'Neill isn't that much longer.
He goes to Marvel. Yep. Yeah. Is Paul Levitz dissing Len Wein and Dick Giordano's work speed a little bit?
He's like urging them along.
Yeah, a little calling them out there. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Hurry up, guys. I got a spot here. I had to put the Atom in this month. I need a Human Target story. Come on.
So he was talking about Brian Nelson did write a novel. And so I'm only going to read 2 paragraphs. I'll try to zip through this fast. He says, "As far as art is concerned, the Batman stories in Detective have been unusually blessed. First, there was Rogers Alston, then Golden, now Newton Adkins. While this last team is not as flashy as its predecessors, it still is more than equal to the task of illustrating the world's greatest manhunter. Newton is a careful, thoughtful penciler with an eye for detail that is downright charming, as witnessed by the glimpse of the Joker in the Arkham Asylum."
Yeah, we love that.
"And Adkins compliments him with his clean but sensitive inking style, making the whole combination a simple delight." Now, of course, I had to read the next paragraph. "The Human Target story was entertaining in both story and art, but as always the case with these stories, I feel it will all be over if I blink. What with the prerequisite teaser, flashback to meet the client, have him tell the story, and watch Chance transform himself, the real meat of the story is always left to transpire over a mere 4 pages. One can't help wondering what nice stories might come about if this formula could be opened up over a longer page length. I agree, Brian.
I will say there's another letter from a guy named Dean Shop, and he mentions he's in love with the Manhunter series that Simonson and Archie Goodwin did. And Paul Levitz says that they won't revive it without them, but there's going to be a high-quality limited edition in black and white that should be available by the time you read this. For details, write Excalibur Enterprises. And I looked that up on Mike's Amazing World. That actually happened. If you look it up, there's a Manhunter comic, not published by DC, but by Excalibur Enterprises. Apparently, it's the first time they reprinted it.
I didn't realize that because I have the one that came out when they reprinted it, like with that gold foil thing. But that's really cool.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I had no idea. I guess this is similar to kind of when they did the Frazetta Shining Knight stories, like
yeah.
the publisher a few years from now. So it's interesting. DC.
Oh, there it is. Manhunter, the Complete Saga. But they call it a trade paperback, but it can't be. It's not very thick.
Yeah, yeah, it can't be. It's like one comic, right? One comic worth of stories. But yeah. Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah, who knew?
Good pull, Chris.
Moving on to the fifth story. The Bogus Butlers, starring Alfred. 5 pages, written by Bob Rozakis, penciled by Jose Delbo, inked by Robert Smith, and reprinted never.
Third out of 4 stories not reprinted from this
one. Really? Alfred in The Bogus Butlers. Haley Mills and Haley Mills. Patty Duke and Patty Duke. Jeremy Irons and Jeremy Irons. James McAvoy and James McAvoy, Spider-Woman and Spider-Woman, Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler, and Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler, Alfred Pennyworth and Alfred Pennyworth. Alfred is scrapbooking when he comes across a newspaper article in which he sees his very own image being brought to justice by the Batman. Logically, in order to find out what this is all about, the very easiest thing to do is infiltrate this gang and pose as the person who the Batman has already arrested. At the crook's hideout, Alfred manages to convince the group to meet again in a location that is owned by Bruce Wayne. When the gang's all there, a knock at the door brings yet another Alfred Pennyworth to the door. A quick couple of fisticuffs later, and it's revealed that the other Alfred Pennyworth was Robin in disguise. Chris, save this story.
I will say one comment that's always stuck in my head. Due to illness, the part of Robin will be played by Alan Alda. Look at Robin on page 5.
Oh, my God.
Wow. I cannot unsee that now.
Hawkeye Pierce as the Boy Wonder. And we know Jose Delbo is Rob Kelly's favorite instructor from the Kubert School.
Yeah.
So the fact that there's a MASH connection, I thought that since I was a kid, why does Robin look like the guy off MASH? Yeah, why didn't Alfred just walk over? Master Bruce, I was wondering, why are you grabbing me in this photo? You know, it's like, no, it's like, I'll put myself in danger and infiltrate this group of criminals.
He does say, hey, I'd rather figure this out. I think he's just doing it for fun.
It's like Barbara. He wants to figure it out for himself.
But it's a riot. He says, this is a situation for a gentleman detective.
Don't you think Bruce would have back to the Batcave and said, Alfred, get this. This guy looked exactly like you.
Apparently, he had Robin dress up as Al. And so they used Alfred's likeness in the sting operation. And he got in the paper. Why didn't they say, hey, Alfred, look, sorry, we borrowed your identity for this sting operation. And it kind of went sideways. Sorry. Because now they think Alfred's a criminal. What?
I think I liked it a little more than you guys. I think it's a kind of charming, silly little thing. I like Alfred scrapbooking. Seen that before. Did you guys catch the name of the staffing agency?
Yes.
Jarvis. Yeah.
Jarvis Inc.
Yeah, that was good.
I like how when Alfred's meeting the bad guys, he has to try to talk like a ruffian. Yeah. I think that's funny. I don't know. Alfred gives a real address, 110 Houston Street. I went and looked on Google Maps and it's not like a brownstone there or anything. It is like some sort of random store. So I was like, oh, well, I thought that was interesting. I thought it was cute. I had the recollection of it. It's definitely silly. It's my second favorite story of the issue after the next one.
I don't dislike it. It's fun. And I like the fact that Robin name drops Arthur Treacher, which that's the fish and chip guy, right?
Yeah.
He's a famous British actor known for playing butlers. And I'd kind of forgotten that because I never ate it at Arthur Treacher's. We have Long John Silver's in this area.
Yeah.
But Arthur Treacher's was a fish and chip place. And I think there's just a handful left in the U.S. now. A lot of people bring that up. Like, oh, remember Arthur Treacher's? Wait a minute. Why'd he bring that up? And then I'm like, oh, yeah, he was the butler guy in like Shirley Temple movies and stuff. Yeah. So it's It's fun. It's cute. We shouldn't over-examine things like this. I like when Alfred gets some action. I like that when Robin and Alfred, they got that nice. And of course, they've expanded upon that over the years where they made Batman be so damaged that Alfred was basically the surrogate dad to Dick more than Bruce in some ways. So I kind of like it when you see them together.
Any story where Alfred punches someone is a good story.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not quite the gentleman punch that we had
by Michael Golden,
but it's still pretty good. It's still pretty good. It's still
pretty good. Yeah, that's a good one.
And we get the good Alfred logo. Martin would like that.
I want a George Tuska Alfred head. That's from the last story. That's definitely a George Tuska Alfred head.
Oh, good catch.
Okay, Paul, let's end this fifth hour.
Ooh, let's bring it home with our sixth story of the issue, where Strike the Assassins. Batman starring in a second story, which we know many letter columnists love when Batman's in two different stories. Anyway, his guest star, I wrote guest starring the Bronze Tiger, not really, guest starring Ben Turner in a hospital gown. 10-pager written, of course, by Denny O'Neill with art by Don Newton and Dan Adkins, has been reprinted in the Tales of the Batman Don Newton, as well as Batman Tales of the Demon from various printings. We open in a hospital corridor as two assassins are about to do what they do, about as well as Ma Murder. But of course, they are stopped by Batman, and we find out that the patient and intended victim is none other than Ben Turner, the Bronze Tiger. Ben is in the hospital after turning on the Sensei and the League of Assassins during the Vengeance Vow. Batman is surprisingly courteous to Ben, who was, as you'll recall, an accessory at best to Kathy Kane's murder. Ben's memory is still messed up, but he does provide Batman with one clue. Quote, "The Sensei mentioned putting the snatch on some kind of geologist." Meanwhile, across town, someone else is being chased by two other assassins. This intended victim chooses to run into a church in the middle of their game of bingo. He smashes the bingo board, much to the consternation of the ladies in the crowd. He is dragged away by the bad guys at gunpoint. The next morning, during Bruce's patented shirtless for Sean workout, Alfred reads him the account of the incident in the paper, with the additional detail that the victim smashed two numbers, the 5 and the 7. From this clue, Bruce, of course, deduces that the man who was taken away was the geologist mentioned by Ben, and that the 5 and 7 referred to grid lines on a map, giving Batman a location. Wow, Denny. A few hours later, at that location, which is a carnival for some reason, a disguised Batman finds his way into the House of Mirrors. Inside, he finds the Sensei himself, who is having the geologist confirm something on a map. He has completed his task, so the Sensei is about to kill him when Batman intervenes and stops the execution. One thug drags the geologist away while the Sensei runs in a different direction. Batman has no choice but to let the Sensei get away, and he does save the geologist, though, by diving off a Ferris wheel that is surprisingly close to a roller coaster to catch the assassin. We are told that this strange meandering case will be coming to a head next issue. To be continued. Chris?
Yeah, it's kind of odd to me to just think that Denny O'Neill wraps up this Batman story with Batman in broad daylight, considering he's the guy that's most known for being the guy that brought the Creature of the Night back. This is a Bob Haney type situation where Batman's in broad daylight at a carnival. So it's kind of weird. That's my overall take. It's not a bad story, but it's just, it feels like just a little snippet of a serial, like an ongoing serial.
Had this Batman, League of Assassins, Ra's al Ghul, Sensei story gotten most of the parts of it. There have been a couple of parts in other magazines, but Sean, what about you? What'd you think?
So I like it. It's definitely like my favorite story of the issue. I love Ben Turner. I like that it's action. I love carnival ride stuff. So I like it a lot.
The art is fantastic, and Newton is just crushing it these days. Page 2, I like the bop on the head that he gives the one guy, and then the orderly runs into Batman. And I do like how this Batman can get affected by regular people. What I think it suffers on page 3, when Batman, like I said, was courteous to Ben, I think we needed a little more context that maybe Batman has already talked to Ben, or he knew he was really okay and under their influence. But he didn't know that last time we saw it, right? Otherwise, it's just weird.
Yeah.
I just think we needed that. The bingo sequence, I thought that was funny. Weird, but funny.
So speaking of funny, so I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. But it's good you said funny. Because if you look at page 3, the very top panel, the assassin's going after Ben Turner. And the assassin says, "For the honor of the League of Assassins and the Sensei." And then it literally looks like the assassin's crotch is saying if that's your product. Because the word balloon is pointing exactly there. But going to what you were saying, understand quote-unquote comic book logic and everything. It absolutely makes no sense why this guy runs into a bingo hall.
And has the presence of mind to hit the five. Like, who did he think was going to get that clue? Batman? He doesn't know Batman.
Other than a bingo hall, if there would have been some other way to communicate 5 and 7, I would have thought this was a top tier story. But that part is kind of
How did he know a 5 and a 7 was going to be up there? Did he just happen to run into the church / bingo hall, or did he like, I got to find a bingo hall quick? You know?
Then we get the workout, which I'm sure was your favorite part, Sean, and Bruce's huge jump of logic that this guy was the geologist. He's leaving them a clue and let's go check this place out. And yet another circus. What's the deal?
Christopher, I need you to look at page 7. So Batman's in costume for the cotton candy. I need you to read off the name of the cotton candy.
Nam-tab's cotton candy. I'm sure Rob Kelly loves. That was his code name for a while there, because he read that Batman used that as an alias before. And I think it's so cool that Batman has disguised himself as either a Hank Williams Jr. or Waylon Jennings. I can't decide which.
It was funny because you were talking about Alan Alda. My two celebrity cameos, I think he looks like Jim Jones.
Okay.
But if you look at the sailor to the left of him, Matt Damon makes an appearance in this issue.
There you go.
Probably what, like... 10 years before he was born?
Probably so. Is that Shelley Winters eating an ice cream cone in the foreground? I don't know. She's Ma Parker, right? I will say, I hate to even say this, I love Don Newton. I love his artwork. He's one of my favorite comic book artists. But I have to point out that I think this is very unusual for him. On page 8, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead. If I do, I'm sorry. The guy's got the knife to his throat. When Batman's hand comes in and grabs the wrist, those two hands look way too small in front of the guy's face. It's weirding me out a little bit. I think that's the only thing that jumped out at me, is because he's always so great with anatomy. It almost makes me wonder if there wasn't some kind of weird paste-up change or something for some reason, or in somebody in post-production messed something up, because I can't even imagine Don Newton doing that.
I didn't catch that, but you make a good point.
It might be something weird like that. I don't know. Oh, backtracking real quick, I got to point out, because you guys have brought this up before, and we brought this up, how Denny is sometimes rude to his family members.
Yeah.
When Alfred, his take on why he would leave a 5 and 7, Bruce says, nice try, but dead wrong. You know? Like, geez, Bruce, you know.
Good catch. I like this scene. I feel like this story was just a little disjointed, maybe because they said we have a limited page count, because it's weird that it's 10 pages. It was Don Newton. Did he go on a vacation, said, I can only do 10 pages this month? We don't know the whole story about that, why this was set up the way it was. I think there's some good ideas in here. I just don't think it's executed well. But like I said, the art is fabulous. I like the scene with the roller coaster. I think that's...
Yeah.
But it does wrap up very quickly in one panel, which speaks, I think, to the brusque ending of the story.
I do wonder if this was literally part of a story, just how the page is constructed. Normally, there would be a next issue box that runs across the entire bottom of the page, whereas this, it's just panel description.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wonder if they didn't strip a longer story across two issues or something.
And I think the thing is interesting, Batman and the Sensei battle over 6 of the most important lives on the Earth. What does that mean? You know, that sounds interesting. You might want to make a bigger deal of that. It is an interim chapter. We didn't get really much of a full story other than Batman saving the one guy.
Okay, now we have an interesting conundrum. Because normally we take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 70s, where we talk about the most 70s moment. Now we have to update that to the 80s. So I don't know if there was a Gotham 80s British Invasion Club.
I'm going to headcanon that one to say that Gabriel's Horn limps along for another few months into 1980 before it shuts down. Mal and Taryn are still there, trying to bring in the crowds, and then get annoyed when they see that big T being constructed in New York Harbor.
On page 1 of the very first story.
Hey, before page 1, what about the cover?
All
the computer stuff on the cover is definitely 70s stuff.
Robin burning a punch card.
Robin's got a punch card. So that's the first time we've had one on the covers.
I'll let you guys shout out the name of the building that's beside the hot spot.
Oh, the disco.
There is a literal disco beside the hot spot.
Nice.
On page 1. It's a nice way to end the 70s.
That's awesome. I did not have anything in this short story. That's a good one that you found that. That's awesome.
I didn't have have for anything for this one either. Yeah, that's great.
Almost all of mine are kind of the exact same.
And then Commissioner Gordon is the computer and the phones. Yep. I mean, we've seen those many times.
Background Robin, I have the cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes.
Yeah, no digital MP3 files. It's all recorded on cassette tape. At least it wasn't 8-track.
Adams, this is the computer issue, I guess, right?
Yep.
He's ahead of his time. He's basically surfing the internet, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Literally, right?
Alfred, his big computer panel. Chris mentioned Arthur Treacher.
Yeah, that's good. I didn't catch that.
Robin wears an over-the-head mask, which we talked about before.
Yeah, we love that.
Yeah, over his domino mask.
There's a window that opens in the hospital. He's got his compass protractor thing, the geologist.
Oh, yeah.
I think he called it a compass. But look how much the cotton candy is.
Oh, yes. I was so enamored of
That's the stuff you usually get.
Yeah.
When you pointed out the NanTab, I'm like, oh, I wonder if you noticed that. That's funny.
Oh, man.
Alfred gets his news from a newspaper.
Of right course, away. Yeah.
On TV or thing, you know, so yeah. I thought that was interesting.
We keep saying it. There's still stuff in there, but it's all stuff we've sort of mentioned before. It's sort of petered out, which, you know, hey, the 70s have just petered out, right? So it kind of makes sense.
I don't think the 70s were completely over until like 1982, though. You know, the decades never quite click over. Yeah. Right?
Or you could even argue a more defining point was probably MTV started in 1984, right?
81, I think.
81. So I think 81 is probably when you really had that almost like hard, because so many British artists had music videos at the ready. You had like Duran Duran and all of that. Yeah. So I think that's probably the real shifting point.
And a lot of your 70s less photogenic bands just was not going to get any airplay on MTV.
Right. Yeah.
Well, guys, that about wraps it up. Thank you, Chris, for appearing once again on the show. We love having you. You're one of our closest bat relatives, so we really like that. Do you want to talk about what you're working on right now?
Well, thanks, guys. It's been a real blast coming back. I always enjoy it. I love listening to the show, so it's always fun to participate. Yeah, Cindy and I are, of course, plugging away on JLUcast. That's where we cover Justice League Unlimited, and actually we're going to have two very special guest stars in the next couple of months, two bat cousins that I know, who I'm talking to right now, and I give you one guess on who the guest hero is in Sean's episode. But we're really looking forward to that, and we're looking forward to getting to talk to Paul very, very soon. We're going to have you guys on. That's great. Come to Watchtower and have some fun. So, and I pop up all over the network otherwise, but yeah, primarily JLUcast right now, as we go through season three. We're all, you guys are coming to the end of your Batman family coverage, and we're coming to the end of Justice League Unlimited too. So it's, we got to come up with some new shows to do, I guess.
I was going to use this time to announce that the network's closing, but I guess we'll, are we supposed to wait for that?
That's a worse rumor than Superman family.
Are we supposed to wait to announce that? Or is this the officially official?
Oh, man.
Oh, now I told you, Rob's going to fire us, man.
We can't get fired if there's no network.
I guess that's true.
Oh, wow.
Well, thanks again, Chris. We love having you. On that note, we are going to play a podcast promo. And when we return, Sean and I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLUcast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
Welcome back. Now we're going to read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 488, Spooky Switches and Vanishing Cars, with our special guest, the Batpod's own J. David Weider. First up, our guest from this very episode, Network All-Star, our Bat cousin Chris Franklin, informs us that, yep, they did make a Plastic Man in the Mega Elastic Heroes line. It's the only Plaz they made, and he was hard to come by. Oddly enough, I never wanted any of these because I didn't know Plaz existed, and Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and Hulk didn't stretch. But I love that ad. And I did have Stretch Armstrong and Stretch Monster from Kenner, who sued Mego over these. And then he posted some great photos. Check them out. Chris goes on to add, I hate to say anything bad about Joe Giella, who was one of the last golden Silver Age artists standing, but he was one of the most heavy-handed inkers in the business. A newcomer, at least to DC, like Barreto, was especially prone to get his work reworked by Giella. Barreto was an underrated artist in many ways, doing a solid run on the new Teen Titans during one of Marv Wolfman's less inspired periods, writing-wise. But he also drew some of my favorite Masters of the Universe storybooks, as well as The Shadow Strikes. This is far from his best work, and Ralph's hair does indeed look rather odd and off-model. Yeah, I like Ed Barreto, too, and the Teen Titans, and I didn't read Masters of the Universe, but I definitely knew him from the Teen Titans and the Shadow. Back to Chris. I still have my childhood Corgi Jr. Superman van, which is actually silver, which awesome, Chris. And I have since got a replacement for my Supermobile, and I have the larger version of that as well. Even as a kid, the Daily Planet truck, which I had, really flummoxed me with Clark revealing his secret to the world. If a four-year-old calls foul, Corgi, then you may want to rethink that. I had the Daily Planet copter too, everything but the police car at one point, and I have to agree, that is the best scene in any comic book movie. It's magic, it's iconic, and it's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, and just to clarify, I don't remember everything from when I was four. Just random stuff like Robin's stretchy leg and my mom's explanation for it. However, I did forget that Mom Herder was actually on an episode of Batman the Brave and the Bold. She is in the opening of The Menace of the Madniks when Batman gets help capturing her from the haunted tank and the ghost of Jeb Stuart. Wow. Thanks again for the knowledge, Chris. As always, great stuff.
So actually, as Paul was, I'm going off script. So as Paul was reading Chris's letter, something dawned on me that maybe we can no prize the Corgi truck. Coca-Cola had the names on the bottles a couple years ago, and you could go online and order one. Maybe it was the same thing. You could say, Shawn Myers is Superman.
And get your own
is Superman. And everyone would get their own truck. So it wasn't such a surprise that Clark Kent got. Maybe that's how it worked.
There you go.
Bat Cousin Eric pipes in with, Johnny Craig was best known for his work in the 1950s at EC Comics, particularly in the titles Vault of Horror and Crime Suspense Stories, where he was the most frequent lead story and cover artist. Even if you haven't actually read any EC Comics, you may be familiar with Craig's cover to Crime Suspense Stories number 22, which shows a man holding a bloody axe in one hand and a woman's severed head in the other. This cover was so gruesome that it was singled out when EC publisher Bill Gaines testified before a congressional committee about how horror and crime comics, with Gaines attempting to defend the cover as being in good taste by arguing that bad taste would have been if the head was held higher to actually show the bloody neck stump. Needless to say, the committee was not impressed. Anyway, even if you haven't seen that actual cover, it's been homaged and spoofed several times, so you may have seen a secondhand version of Craig's image. So this is Sean interrupting. Even if you think you don't know the image, if you see it, I bet you know. Yeah, I bet you'll see it. Getting back to Eric, Johnny Craig also had a brief run on Iron Man, starting with issue number 2, but he didn't last too long because he was a relatively slow-working artist, and he wasn't especially well-suited to superheroes. While I'm a big fan of Craig's EC work, and even his Warren magazines and Iron Man stories, I do have to admit that the story in Detective 488 was far from his best work. Fair enough, Eric. Thanks for the mini history lesson. And then Bucky749 lets us know that he was having a Batman 66 marathon. Good taste, Bucky.
Next up, our Bat DJ, Matthew Davis, stops by. Hope everybody is bracing themselves. They've been talking on the news about how next week we'll be facing Eclipso, a pretty serious villain. Huh? Oh, an eclipse. Phew, that's a relief. Batman on Borrowed Time by Styx opens with a line, "Don't look now, but here come the 80s, since after this issue, we're officially out of the 70s. This is a decent enough story, but I'm not that crazy about the spook. He seems like a villain that the writers will use so it doesn't seem like other villains are overused." Back then, storylines didn't seem to cross very much between the Bat books, so seeing Selina and Lucia seemed like a big change at the time. Silver St. Cloud only made one appearance outside the Engelhart Rogers run, and that was in an issue of Justice League that Engelhart wrote. Tales of Gotham City, Andy Griffith's show theme. This was a nice, simple story. The title, The Last Duty, is a little ominous, almost like Clem is going to die before he can officially retire. Maybe it's me, but it looks like the artist took the time to make the noses look different on The Lady and the Nut. The Nut had a more pointed nose at first, but after the tunnel, it looks more like the nose that's seen on The Lady. And unless he could master faking voices, Skinsey really took a big chance talking to Clem as the lady and then as the nut. Agreed.
That's a good point.
Batgirl, Beat It by Michael Jackson. No wonder Babs lost the election. She's coming around to her opponent's argument about societal issues having an effect on crime. Of all the professions for a superhero, elected official always seemed like one of the more difficult to do and maintain a secret identity. Could you imagine if Barbara was to run today with all the cable news channels, blogs, and online outlets? Still, she brought two rival gangs to a truce. The Elongated Man, Drive, theme song from Hardcastle and McCormick, because the car in the story looks like the car from the show. I like Ralph. Unlike the other superhero detective in the book, he's not grim and serious all the time. Being married and with a public identity definitely made him stand out from other characters. Definitely. Yeah. Robin, Jenny, 867-5309 by Tommy Two-Tone. Dick's wearing a safari shirt because he's hunting a fox named Jennifer Ann. That's a good line. If he only knew who was coming to him from outer space. The real hero of the story, Dick's libido for keeping him from being kidnapped. Usually it gets him in trouble. Thanks, Matthew.
Bat Nephew Isamu is next up, and boy, does he bring the Richie Rich research. Was that the title of one of his comics? It might be the only one that wasn't a title. He says, fun show, uncles, gentlemen, as always. And call to action received, Uncle Sean. Let's see if your Richie Rich Best of the Year's Digest has these character first appearance stories you have asked for. Richie Rich. Richie Rich first appeared as a backup feature in Little Dot Number 1, The Dancing Lessons, from September of 1953. He would be an ongoing backup strip in Harvey's Little Dot and Little Lotta comics for 7 years before the publisher decided to give him his own title.
I guess they're making up for it, right? They're making up for it now.
Yeah, that surprises me. Then Isamu goes on. I urge everyone to look at the comments section because Isamu did a fantastic job. He then gives the first appearances of Cadbury, Irona, and Dollar. And that is fantastic. You did a phenomenal job. The only thing, Isamu, be careful, because whoever's going to start a Richie Rich podcast is coming after you to be on the show. You're going to be there, Professor Paul. Isamu then goes on to say, hopefully the stories in your digest live up with these. If not, then good luck finding these comics on eBay. Let me tell you, that Best of the Years, it's just stories. There's no rhyme or reason to any of it, which is fine, I guess. I don't feel as if I've been tomahawked, as at least Richie Rich is in it. And Bat Cousins, you have got to check out the images of these first appearances that Isamu posted on the website because he did a fantastic job. He then goes on to add, oh, wait, you meant the spook. Yes, he boasted about his suspended animation trick in his fourth comic book appearance in Batman number 276, June of 1976, when he studied in India. Oh, and Batman is not really dead in that scene. He had studied in India too. And of course, he had posted pictures of those stories. Fantastic job. He then goes on to say, the Batman, The Peril of the Penguin book that was released the same month as Detective 488 was an 18-page promotional mini comic found hermetically sealed inside specially marked boxes of Post Super Sugar Crisp cereal that was sold at the time. My understanding is that kids would likely have gotten more of a buzz from the super sugared sounding cereal than from the comic book story. Though you do get to see Cowboy Penguin, likely because, as Uncle Sean said about DC Comics in the late 70s, he was trying to make Terra Man happen. But don't blame him. My dad tried to make Terra Man happen in the late 2010s. And then he says, I don't see why the Podman show, talking about the Odd Man, would be so short-lived. You just cover that one story with a different guest each episode. It would be a different show each time. So it's almost like the way the network treats that Dr. Fate first issue special. Like behind the curtain, anytime someone joins the network, we have to record a show about that episode, and then they either threaten to release it or that to keep us in under our contract. Not a bad idea, Isamu, but seriously, thanks. That was a lot of work, but super fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Isamu. Hard to top those comments, but we do have a few more. We've got Bat Cousin Brian Schufo, who stops by to say, if Charles D. Brown and Kent Phoenix are still around, I'm sure they would love to be a guest on the show. These two, along with Uncle Elvis, were among the top three writers I remember seeing in the letters pages in the 80s. I had heard recently that Uncle Elvis had passed away, but I hope the other two are still with us and maybe listening to some of the Fire and Water podcasts. Boy, I would love that to be the case, Brian. I remember T.M. Maple as well.
And I think T.M. Maple passed away.
I think he has too. Yeah, so great stuff. And then up, Bat Cousin and two-time past guest, our pal from Over the Ocean, Martin Gray, says, thanks for another fun show. Far more fun than the issue itself. The book is getting blander by the month. He's got a point there.
Yeah.
It's good to hear David on the show, and the features were great as ever, especially the creator focus. Thank you, Martin. Mm-hmm. What caught my eye? Not much. I like the caricature full Johnny Craig art on Tales of Gotham City. It reminded me of those old Just a Story stories. I remember the spook showing up and ignoring the rule that all comic book robes must be purple. Kurt Schaffenberger putting paid once again to the idea that he was old-fashioned by being the only artist to draw contemporary clothes and the idea of Batgirl and Robin stories, if not the execution. I know Ben Oda was a revered veteran letterer, but goodness me, his title lettering is almost always so throwaway, so ratty looking. This time he does make an effort with a Batgirl strip, but then misspells Ed Barreto in the Elongated Man story. I missed that.
I did not read that backwards.
Yeah, you must not have. Sean, regarding the feedback, you really do have to watch The Traitors. The US version isn't the best. Try the British or the Australian. The Shadow of Bat in the last panel of the Batgirl story is pretty subtly done. I don't think anyone mentioned that. No, it did not. That's a good point. And regarding the Robin story, I hate tales beginning in media res in the best of times, and it's even worse when we're talking short stories. Let's start at the very good beginning. It's a very good place to start. Even
yay!
I got that one. Oh, and I'm bringing Yorkshire puddings filled with jam to the barbecue. Yum. And then a new commentator, Mallow, stops by the reunion to add, I sure wish that cover blurb was true. The entire Batman family? Sadly, not even close. No Huntress, no Man-Bat. Hey, I like Ralph Dibny, but unless he starts wearing a cape and cowl, he doesn't qualify for the book. Not sure I'd go that far, but I hear you, Mallow. And thanks for comments and keep coming.
Bat Cousin and fashionista Liz Ann Oswald says, impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover isn't bad. Yeah, the spook has a creepy costume, but he looked cool in Who's Who. The cop story isn't too bad. As a slice of life, it's kind of fun. I'm digging Commissioner Gordon's swinging bachelor pad and his cool smoker's jacket. I'm shocked no one mentioned it in Gabriel's Horn. You can't get more 70s than a smoker's jacket. That's very true. We should have caught that one.
Good catch, Lizanne.
Not sure about Babs's green woman smoker jacket. It's still a cool look. Or are those bathrobes? Not sure.
See, I thought they were bathrobes, but I think Lizanne's right.
I think she is too. And finally, Bat Cousin Brett Young had this to say. Hello, Bat Cousins. Sorry I'm late. I was watching The Black Hole, which I totally did watch for real. It had like robots and a black hole and stuff. And that one scene, man, what a scene. Also, here's some Turkey Hill iced tea. Not going to lie, this issue was a rough one. Don Newton saves the first story with his usual amazing art. I love the collection of ghoulish publishers. Each character is so unique, which is the antithesis of a lot of artists back then. Just incredible work. I thought a nice twist to the story would have been if all the cops thought Batman was Margaret Thatcher instead of the spook. I'm not sure how that would have helped the story, but it would have at least shown the spook had a sense of humor. But judging by his bedsheet as a costume look, I don't think he was very creative. Another tough outing for Batgirl. Although I'd like to learn that move where she can nerve pinch a guy's neck and his entire body flips up into the air to double kick his fellow gang members. Speaking of this gang, what year do they think this is? I was waiting for them to start snapping their fingers while they encircle Batgirl for a musical number.
Yay!
That is, if she's not too busy casually riding her motorcycle through police headquarters. And my God, that Gordon residence. I know real estate comes cheap in Gotham, but that's above and beyond. Is Gordon on the take? Is he actually Hugh Hefner? That might explain the last panel. I so remember that Corgi ad. I had the Daily Planet helicopter and the Supermobile. I'm sure I put them in my pocket at some point. The Supermobile fist would pull out just a little bit. Just enough to, of course, you know, break off, which didn't happen to mine. The only thing I'll say about the Elongated Man story is that it made me miss Roy Raymond. Oh, that's dirty pool, man. The Robin story was okay. Dick may have found a new one-semester college girlfriend in Jennifer Ann. Unless he admits to following her and asks her back to his van parked in the woods. I'm surprised the kidnappers didn't see his van while they were driving through. why are there so many vans driving through the woods? Maybe report that to the local cops, who all look exactly alike. Robin is doing some cool parkour up the wall. Good thing he had that comic panel border to lean against so he could get through the window. Why does a new college sports stadium have prison bar windows? Well, this issue was exhausting. I've got to run. Great Aunt Ethel took a stroll in the woods and got hit by four vans at the same time. That doesn't sound like fair play to me. Okay, now we are going to take a look at social media. First, you may have seen on the Batman feed that Paul and Paul were visiting a place called Paul's Deli. Now, if you saw that, it's because you looked at Twitter yesterday in terms of recording time, because I didn't post it when it was. So if you go and look at Twitter now, it is there. But Paul was visiting family in Williamsburg, Virginia in early April, and he had lunch with loyal listener and past guest, our Bat cousin, Paul Wildenberger. So they, of course, ate at the aptly named Paul's Deli. We've included a picture of them in the portrait gallery, and it is really on Twitter now. Not like how I saw Black Hole back in when I went to school, but really, for real, it is on Twitter now. Now we're going to acknowledge the Bat family members who shared our podcast on social media. We appreciate the support from our social media community, and they include from Facebook, A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Scott Rowland, Tom Pinsonault, Doug Game Master, Matthew Davis, Magazines and Monsters, John Hyatt or Hijat, H-I-J-A-T-T, Jay Campbell, Jack Dower, Tim Price, Max Romero, James Williams, Chris Franklin, Don Lindberg, Mike Thomas, Jim Weasley, Brett Young, Clinton Robinson. Then we're going to switch over to Twitter, where Paul Wildenberger is the first name on that list. Rodney Trainum, Jim Ball, Scott X, Codex Omniversa, Chris at BTO and Batbooks, Just Trying to Browse, Dr. Pop Culture, and Martin Gray. And on Twitter, we had some really cool interactions this month from everyone else, not from me. Martin Gray made a mention that on iTunes, the podcasts now have transcriptions, so you can hit that button. And I'm very interested to see what iTunes does with the way I say synopsis-sosises, since I can't say the plural of synopsis-sosises. Isamu said that he is proofreading volume 2 of Who's Zooms, which I absolutely can't recommend enough. I have the first issue. I can't wait for the second issue. But he's proofreading it. So he said, Pope Brenda me help begins proofreading, which you have to read backwards. So someone who runs that Twitter account said, Tub, Ton, Straw Crab, Elik, Azad, which is, but not backwards like Satana, because we don't want that to happen. Then the last one, and no offense against Isamu, but maybe the greatest Twitter interaction is Stephen E. Schend, S-C-H-E-N-D, posted a cover of Batman Family number 11, which is the wedding issue. And he said, iconic duo. And then Patch Zerker said, if you're cosplayers and you're getting married, might I suggest this? And then whoever runs our Twitter account said, and if you do, weed, W-E apostrophe D, which is wed, would love to have you on our show. Martin mentioned that we've been campaigning for years. Yeah, so I'm over buying action figures, but those action figures I absolutely will buy. As soon as they're solicited, I'm putting my request in for those figures. And we want to thank everyone for all of that, because that
thank you, everybody.
Fantastic. Like, that always makes my day when I read stuff like that. But before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. We've added 432 episodes of Dr. Fate, first issue special. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. At certain levels, you can get a call out on our show of your choice. And our special thanks go out to our Bat cousin and future guest, Brian Schufo, who has asked to be named on Batman Family Reunion. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
And remember, we're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount that you can give helps defray the cost. And I promise not to use any of your donations to perfect my memory drug device to use on Paul to mind warp him into changing this show into the Kylie cast. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And thank you, thank you, thank you.
That'll do it for the feedback section. Thanks again to our special guest, Chris Franklin, podcasting superstar, for appearing on this episode. We appreciate you listening and hope very much you will join us next month as Batman finally makes good on his vengeance vow and we get the premiere of Black Lightning.
Thanks, everyone.